Good afternoon, everyone. Great to see so many of you with us today in our event about documenting human rights abuses and transitional justice in Syria. My name is Reem Turkmani. I am the research director of the Syria Conflict Research Program based at LSE. The Conflict Research Program covers the conflict and its drivers in 5 different countries. Syria is one of them. And we are very privileged at this program to have academics, including the head of the program, Professor Mary Kaldor, who have experience from many other conflicts, especially on the relationship between the documentation and transitional justice. When we were setting up our research plan at the beginning of the program, it was Yavor, one of the co-authors of the paper, who raised a very important question based on his experience on documentation in the Balkan. He said, yes, well, we all hear that the Syrian war is considered the most documented conflict in history, but is this documentation really paving the way for justice? So to answer this, we teamed Yavor with a Syrian researcher with a very excellent experience on documenting human rights abuses in Syria. And together they planned and implemented this research that they're gonna present today. So we're gonna start our event today with contributions from the two co-authors, starting with Yavor Rangelov. Yavor is assistant professorial research fellow at LSE Ideas. He also chairs the governing board of the Humanitarian Law Center based in Belgrade, and he also co-chairs the London Transitional Justice Network. Yavor has published extensively in the area of transitional justice, human rights, security, and civil society in a variety of contexts. So Yavor, we'll start with you. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Reem. Just picking up from you, I think our main sort of question in tackling this work was, yes, there is huge amount of documentation, potentially unprecedented, on human rights violations that are committed in Syria. But to what extent is this documentation effort able to catalyze and support transitional justice processes? And we were sort of interested in the full range of transitional justice processes. So those that have to do with perpetrators, criminal prosecutions, judicial mechanisms, and non-judicial mechanisms that emphasize and sort of focus on victims that are about recognition and redress, such as reparations and also restitution of land and property. We sort of recognize the fact that different types of transitional justice mechanisms require different kinds of documentation and also use very different standards of proof. And that sort of led us to the investigation, which involved sort of mapping and analyzing the documentation activities of, on the one hand, international actors such as UN fact-finding and bodies that are involved in investigation for the purposes of justice, as well as international NGOs, but also we conducted 15 interviews with civil society groups, Syrian civil society groups, in order to understand what they're documenting and for what purposes. So what I will do is very briefly highlight a couple of our findings and recommendations, and they're all available in the report, our paper, which is the accompanying publication for this event. And I think the first finding and sort of the good news in a way is that this research revealed that more and more actors involved in documentation are taking a justice-sensitive approach. In other words, they're specifically documenting for transitional justice purposes. However, what we also found is that when they do that, it tends to be, in the overwhelming majority of cases, it tends to be about accountability, it tends to be about criminal prosecution. And then the second and sort of related finding is really about the fact that there are significant gaps in the documentation of human rights violations in Syria, which have important implications for these catalytic and supporting functions that documentation should play in any future transitional justice processes. And we sort of grouped them in two kinds. One related to accountability. And here what we found is that most of the documentation has been about atrocity crimes, abuses committed either by the regime or by ISIS and other extremist groups. And effectively, sort of directing much less attention to Syria-based actors that are not in one of these two categories, but also, and very important, I think, for all of us studying conflict, external actors. The role of external actors in sort of directly perpetrating forces under their command violations is documented by some international actors, but we found very little evidence about documentation that can support aiding and abetting liability of international actors, given the number of, external actors, given the number of external actors that have been involved in the conflict. And the fact that international law provides for liability for holding them accountable in situations where they have provided support to the warring factions with knowledge that these actors may use that support for committing atrocity crimes. I think the aiding and abetting aspect and sort of documentation that can support future accountability processes for external actors based on aiding and abetting liability is a particularly troubling and significant gap. However, the most significant gap that we found in the documentation efforts we reviewed has to do with reparative and restorative justice. It has to do with sort of non-criminal prosecution types of mechanisms, particularly reparations and restitution of land and property. There has been a huge emphasis on sort of mobilizing and channeling resources and attention towards documentation for holding perpetrators to account, which is not matched with similar attention and resources directed towards documentation that can actually make a huge difference in the lives of many Syrians. And I think this finding about reparative and restorative justice is important because other research conducted by others suggests that for many Syrians, some of the most pressing justice concerns and issues related to transitional justice that are real priority have to do precisely with these aspects. For instance, research on Syrian refugees in neighboring countries who point out that issues around housing, land, and property violations are the most significant sort of justice need for them and also a prerequisite for refugee return. So very briefly on our recommendations, with these findings in mind, as you can imagine what the sort of the focus of our recommendations really is about rebalancing the documentation effort. Rebalancing it within the accountability sphere by bringing in more resources and attention and directing it to those types of actors responsible for violations that are currently neglected, sort of non-regime and non-ISIS Syria-based actors and external actors, including those who may be liable for aiding and abetting atrocity crimes. And on the other hand, rebalancing the overall documentation effort away from a sort of almost exclusive focus on accountability when documentation is conducted specifically for justice purposes, and ensuring that more attention and resources again are directed towards documentation that can support reparative and restorative justice, and taking sort of seriously the concerns and the priorities of Syrians, particularly around compensation and restitution of land and property. And then my final sort of comment, and something that we flagged in the report, is that actually there is evidence in the Syrian case that documentation can become a catalyst for justice and can support it effectively, and it comes from universal jurisdiction prosecutions. A growing number of criminal prosecutions based on universal jurisdiction, primarily in Europe, that suggests that when Syrian civil society groups and international actors together with a sort of like-minded, interested, sympathetic states come together, and when the documentation effort is very focused and the collaboration is strategic, it does end up bearing fruit. And what we do is we reflect on that lesson and invite others so that some of the emerging successes with universal jurisdiction prosecutions could be potentially replicated in other areas of transitional justice in the future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Yavor, and thank you for sticking to time. So it's time now to introduce our second speaker and co-author of the paper, Sima Nassar. Now, those who know Sima very well and know what she does every day would introduce her simply with one word. She is a hero, a real hero. The more formal introduction is that she is a human rights defender who has worked for the last 9 years in particularly on the file of the detainees and disappeared people in Syria. She worked extensively in documenting the violation of human rights, particularly against women. She is a co-founder of Ornamo for Justice and Human Rights Organization, and the WE Network, W-E Network, which is a framework to create a safe environment for women, human rights defenders in the entirety of the MENA region. So Sima, the floor is yours.
Greeting everyone. Thank you, Ri. Thank you very much for this. And thank you, Lever, for your input. And I would like to start from where you ended. Yes, the criminal prosecutions in Europe are a particularly great thing and also consistent with the transitional justice, because they support the narrative of victims and affected communities and validate their experiences of injustice, which is very good. However, at the same time, the limitations of this approach from a transitional justice perspective are becoming apparent. Only a small subset of crimes and perpetrators are likely to be prosecuted in this way. Moreover, the delegation of cases for investigation and prosecution may be more aligned with the interests of states than with the interests of justice. Of the exercise of universal jurisdictions becomes another tool for pursuing counter-terrorism objectives, which prioritizes the prosecution of terrorism-related offenses over human rights abuses. The risk of co-option of civil society actors and documentation looms large. Also, similar tensions and risks can be detected in the interactions of Syrian civil society groups with international actors. Most of our respondents collaborate closely with UN investigative mechanism and the human rights bodies. These collaborations reflect the strategic choices of civil society actors about how to put their documentation to use. However, they also generate much frustration. Some of the frustration is about international actors acknowledging the violations but failing to stop them. There is also frustration with the ways Syrian groups are treated by some international actors. While they require a lot of details, scrutiny, and speed to report a situation, in return, a little effort as made to protect those who do the reporting. In 2012, Razan Zaytouneh wrote in her obituary to our colleague Hassan Azhari, who was checking the data for their center as one of his many activities. What is going to happen after documenting one name after the another and making the quest after another? I work as a grave digger who buries the dead while yawning and then display their obituaries at the Museum of International Organization. Why the international community so keen on documenting the crimes and under its watch. Why does the international community care that much about the organizing and accuracy in monitoring the victims' groans and then employing them in numbers, testimonies, and tables? Can we imagine how frustrated she would be if she knew that this has been happening literally and not metaphorically for years, as exhibitions are held to display pictures of the bodies of Syrian torture victims in international museums and not only the obituaries? Returning to the research, not to the challenges in it, but to the available opportunities, I will address only one, perhaps not the most important for some, but it's my favorite. There is another opportunity revealed in our research on civil society that concerns gender feminist organization with a gender perspective and organization led by women, tend to be more concerned with the reparative and restorative dimensions of transitional justice and more effective in integrating them in their work. In fact, they are already doing important work to address some of gender bias evident in ongoing criminal prosecutions in Europe. For example, they have used their access to a victim's witnesses and evidence to ensure that investigation indictments are expanded to include previously neglected offenses involving sexual and gender-based violence. The emphasis of such groups on victim-centered and gender-sensitive approaches has the potential to make important contributions to future transitional justice process aimed at the truth-telling, compensation, and commemoration of the civilian victims of war, reconciliation and non-recurrence of rights violations. Unlocking that potential depends on strengthening the connectivity and communication between women's groups and documentation groups, as well as promoting gender mainstreaming in the documentation space. I would like to conclude with an important recommendation that I would like to draw attention to with my limited allocated time. So I decided to talk about funding, which was mentioned in the paper as one of the challenges facing Syrian civil society. It seems that it has a very important role here. The process of reviewing the documentary work is not easy at all. Any effort to improve and develop databases, saving, analyzing, classifying, genderizing, and dealing with data without bias is a very expensive process. The data is very huge. That is on the same magnitude of what has been happening in the past 10 years. And it requires core funding and a small army of people that work with a lot of faith in the importance of this work. The recommendation is not only about guaranteeing enough resources appropriate to support the civil society documentation effort that intended to catalyze and support the full stream of traditional justice processes and mechanism, prioritizing women's-led group and encouraging activities that promote gender equality and sensitivity in the documentation space. But it's also necessary to reconsider the methods used by donors, the impractical disbursement mechanism, the difficulties of transferring money inside Syria, for example, and many, many more. Actually, this entire research has a call to everyone to stand up and try to make a difference. Yes, we are very good, and we are doing fine, but we need to do more and do better. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Sima, and thank you also particularly for focusing on the distinctive efforts of the organization that are led by women, or the organization that focus on gender equality. We'll move to our next panelist. We are very privileged today to have with us Professor Ruti Teitel, who is a professor of comparative law at New York Law School. She's also the co-chair of the American Society of International Law, which is an interest group on transitional justice and the rule of law. She's also a lifetime member of the Council of Foreign Relations and the author of several books in transitional justice and human rights, including transitional justice and humanities law. So Professor Ruti, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. It's a wonderful opportunity to engage with the LSC authors here, a longtime collaborator, Yavor Rangelov and Sima, who both have done great work with this report. So I wanna focus on three points coming out of transitional justice studies that really show us the sui generis nature of transitional justice in Syria and the significance of the recommendations of the report. First is the relationship of justice and peace here, and that is that we're talking about a conflict that has not ended, and we are talking about justice before a peace deal. And so this inverts the ordinary relationship of justice and peace. If you think about Nuremberg, it's the 75th anniversary today of the Nuremberg Tribunal. Well, that was considered to be the Allies, you know, producing justice at the end of the war. This is not the case here regarding Syria. And so it's more like the intra-conflict ICTY, the Balkans, the agreement regarding amnesties and justice between Northern Ireland and the UK, Colombia, the ongoing questions and the recent peace deal concerning Colombia and the FARC. And I'll say a little something more about this later. So this is the question and the goal, if we're talking about justice before the peace, is a sustainable peace, okay? And what can justice contribute to a sustainable peace? And I'm really going to pick up on some of the themes that Yavor and Sima have already introduced. So the second point here is this question of, again, the sui generis aspect, the fact that we're intra-conflict means that while ordinarily it would be the state that worries about transitional justice, that produces legislation, that hears the claims of victims, we don't have that here. And so we are in a moment where there are other actors, and the report very comprehensively studies these actors. What we have today is a global approach to transitional justice. So we see transnational actors and subnational actors. So on the transnational actors front, I'm just gonna highlight and say a little something more about them later, but you can think of the UN, the Independent International Commission of Inquiry, as well as the General Assembly created mechanisms, which is really coordinating all of, you know, a lot of these documentation efforts. Notably, there's no tribunal, okay? And because of the political context of this question of transitional justice before the peace, we don't have that. And then the subnational actors, we can talk about civil society and so many organizations, notable organizations involved. And then the third, which the report brings out, is the role of other states and the way we seem to have an international community of concern that's coming out of the universality jurisdiction. And so I want to say something about that in just a second. The third that relates to both this inverted relationship of justice before the peace and the beyond the state aspect of transitional justice raised Syria is that there are going to be multiple goals. And I'm probably, you know, if we think about a spectrum, transitional justice runs the spectrum, as the report reminds us, between, you know, a spectrum of retributive goals to reparatory and redress, and one might add a forward-looking sustainable peace, okay, and non-recurrence of conflict. And so obviously there's going to be a lot to do, and often there may be competing aspects to these goals. So what has happened so far? What we've seen so far is significant documentation, as the report brings out, documentation that has been coordinated and connected to criminal accountability. And so we see the work of the Commission of Inquiry, as well as the work of the mechanism that is doing significant coordinating the documentation by civil society. And this is very significant, without a doubt. In fact, universality jurisdiction, which all what that means is that other states, primarily in Europe, have the power, legal power, to prosecute cases involving Syrian perpetrators of crimes in Syria. And that, you know, in Germany, in France, this has been significant. I think it points to the fact that there is an international community of concern, even if there isn't a UN established tribunal. And they have not only, they have created a record, not only have they been able to indict and potentially exclude perpetrators from future political power, but they have been able to create a record, and because it's in a criminal context, at the highest standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. And you could arguably say that they have created a community of nations that have an interest in accountability in Syria. And this is at a time when universal jurisdiction had really been waning, and so there's a resurgence of interest. And that's very significant, and it's opened the door to other accountability in the future. But what the report brings out is that there is other work to be done, and a gap, because, as mentioned, transitional justice involves really the conception of justice in periods of political flux. And you don't have political consolidation yet of a future in Syria. And what you have is, and really the most significant offense that has implications for the future in Syria, is forced displacements. Millions and millions, 11 million of refugees and internally displaced persons. And so the question becomes, we have, you know, significant progress on three levels going after defendants in these involving atrocious crimes against humanity. But there are these atrocious crimes, and forced displacement is among them. One of the problems is how to document for those victims, the many refugees and migrants, how to move forward for a future for them that will involve not just redress, but restitution of their land. And for this, we need, and this is absolutely critical for any forward-looking political transition, for sustainable peace, you're going to need this level of justice. And the question will be how to move forward here. And now transitional justice is widely recognized to include economic factors and to involve root causes. And so for a durable peace, and I look here to a very good example, is Colombia. Colombia is on the fourth year since the peace deal in Havana. And part of what they've been able to do is bring justice into the peace deal. And in particular, this, you know, we have a law, there's a law in Colombia about restitution of lands that were taken by paramilitary and the FARC. But this involves documentation. And for some years now, there have been victims groups that are working to document. And this has become part of the important ongoing issue of jurisdiction for the peace in Colombia. This is a part of what the report identifies as an important missing piece. And that is that for a durable peace and political transition in Syria, there's going to have to be a need to attend to documentation of forced dispossession, forced displacement, often rising to the level of crime against humanity on an, you know, we're talking about ethnic cleansing, political cleansing, religious cleansing, and by quote unquote of the land. And so what is much needed is documentation of these patterns. Of these patterns of dispossession. And so, and this can be made a part of the future, any future peace settlement. But what is important right now is that there be adequate documentation in order to be able to restore land and property to victims, but also to be able to move forward and to be able to assure other the rest of society that there is going to be the possibility of a peaceful political transition. I would add just at the end, I'm concerned about my time here. I would just add that in addition to these elements, looking to the future, and often transitional justice is thought to be about the past, about a more backward looking, and even restoration has a past flavor to it. You know, not at all. Transitional justice is really about, you know, the connection of political transition to justice. And here we're ahead of the piece. So we need to think about also about the narratives being produced by these documentation efforts, by the Commission of Inquiry, and here for the future, for the future of Syria, what narrative is being produced, and the importance of truth and documentation to any possible shared understanding of what has been happening and of the critical moment in Syria. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ruti, for a very rich insight and reflection on the results of the report. It raises very important questions. I move to our next panelist, Salma Kahali. Salma is one of those brilliant feminists who are leading Syrian organizations that Seema spoke about. Salma has been, for the last 6 years, working as the executive director of Dawlati, which is a leading Syrian civil society organization working on inclusive justice, civic engagement, and campaigning with families and survivors of detention and disappearance. She also has 15 years experience as an activist for social justice in the MENA region. Seema, without further ado, the floor is yours.
That's okay. Thank you very much for a very interesting paper and very interesting discussion. And I'll just maybe go on from where Ruti was had started and maybe continue on a discussion about documentation and the gaps, because I think that there's two parts to what Ruti was saying that I think very fit in very well with what I wanted to say. First, in terms of the fact that we aren't in a position to have a national transitional justice process. Many of the traditional mechanisms and tools and the ways we think about transitional justice are not available to us now. And Assyrian organizations that have been talking about the day after for 9 years, you know, we have had to think about what is our role now? How do we work towards justice? What does that mean in the current moment? What are we documenting? What kind of networks, capacity building, groundwork are we laying for justice in the future? And what can we do to achieve justice in the nearer term? And you know, and that includes the documentation and case building file that, you know, or accountability and case building that the report discusses very much. There's also the work that has been going on with organizations supporting victims organizing and organizing of, especially in the on detention and disappearance, but also beginnings of that kind of organizing on other issues. And then the third file, which is more the memorialization and then documenting towards memorializing the conflict based on truth telling, based on including narratives that aren't highlighted very much in the conflict. And I think, you know, this has been a moment where we are the last few years where we're trying to look at where those gaps are. And at all these stages, the role of women and women-led organizations, you know, has been important in trying to push for a more inclusive approach to justice and a broader approach to justice. What counts as justice? What kinds of crimes are addressed when we talk about justice? who is involved in that conversation, how are victims involved in it, and how are their needs integrated into any mechanisms that are developed. And women-led, and the discussion, I think, about documentation is important, not only in terms of what crimes are being documented or violations. So it's, I think, in addition to the need to document, so I think there's, you know, in addition to the need to document, for instance, HLP violations, violations related to housing, land, property rights, there's also a need to look at how the documentation is done, who does it. So if, for instance, in the documentation of issues such as detention, for instance, or we need more gender analysis, we need to have looking at what are the violations that are happening, how does this impact on women, how does this impact on women differently than it impacts on men, how does this then also how do we make sure that full scope of the impact of detention is being captured and addressed in any justice mechanisms that we are talking about. And I think that's something that women-led and feminist organizations have been working on, is to really broaden that discussion, even on issues that are well-documented, like detention. We are trying to address more fully the gaps in that documentation. So whether that includes the work that we've been doing with women-led groups on the impact of, for instance, sexual violence in detention on women, the economic impact, the political impact, the social impact, all of that, how does this impact, how does this feed into the impact on victims and their needs vis-a-vis justice? What does justice look like for them? Another part of the work we've been trying to do as organizations such as, you know, whether it's Dawlati, Bada'il, Women Now, and many of our other organizations that are working on the ground, Starpoint, is to really work to make sure that these victims' needs are integrated into that discussion much more clearly, and women's needs in particular. I just wanted to add one more kind of documentation that I think many of us are also embarking on and have been doing, and that is related to oral history archiving. And there are several organizations, including Dawlati, that have been trying to lead this kind of effort from the ground with communities, documenting the stories of groups and marginalized communities, in particular women, and their experiences of the conflict. And from that, I think it adds another layer of understanding of the crimes and the violations that have been committed, how they impact on communities and in women in particular. And then again, add a layer of how they understand justice and what does that look like for them locally, in their communities, in different circumstances. And I think these are all important kinds of documentation that feed into then, you know, what kinds of mechanisms we create and what kinds of what justice looks like. I'd like to take one example very quickly, if I have time, of an issue that we have worked on, and that is with Women Now and with women in communities, is the impact of detention on relatives of detained and disappeared persons, in particular their impact on women. And that has had the effect of, you know, documenting their stories and their testimonies and working with them to, first of all, acknowledging the impact of detention, not just on those that are detainees, but also on their families and on communities, how that impact is also gendered. And then how can we include those women in particular in the discussions on detention, in decision-making or in advocating for what are the priorities when we deal with detention. It has, I believe, made a, you know, and I think it has made a a big difference in how we discuss the issue of detention and really widened the scope and also really centered the main the victims and the main stakeholders in that discussion. And I think that has, you know, that kind of documentation, that kind of work has led to a market a more inclusive approach to discussing this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Salma. That's very interesting. Thank you also for highlighting and for working on really important gaps that not many organizations cover, such as the perception of justice and including the locals, especially women, in the discussion about justice. They are not just victims that we're documenting, you know, they have to be involved in the discussion. That takes me to our last panelist for today, Brahim Olavi, who is the founder of the Syrian Legal Development Program, which is an NGO working on fighting impunity in Syria and the promotion of the rule of law. Ibrahim is also a barrister at Gornica 37, which is an international justice chamber. Brahim?
Perfect. Thank you so much, Reem, and thank you for all the previous speakers and the excellent report. I'll share just a couple of quick thoughts on the kind of documentation that has been going on in the past in the Syrian conflict, and perhaps a couple of kind of challenges moving forward. It was always kind of surprising, you know, when I grew up before the kind of Syrian conflict started, it was always that, you know, when we hear about previous conflicts that happened, that, you know, there was always this argument that we did not know and therefore we could not act. How could this have happened? You know, the elder also used to look at the elders and they say, you know, we never understood the severity of what was going on. Fast forward, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and you get the Syrian conflict, which is, as has already been said, one of the most well-documented conflicts. So in the past, we did not know that much and perpetrators got away with crimes. And now we know so much and perpetrators are still able to get away with their crimes. So how did that happen? And I have a couple of kind of theories about why did that occur. First of all, you know, this is kind of a quote that gets attributed to so many different people about, you know, you kill one or two or 10 people, you might face a trial, end up with a life sentence. You kill 100,000, you end up invited to a peace conference. And so I think the perpetrators in Syria knew that, you know, for them to be able to crush this, they need to overload the system, not hide their crimes, overload the documentation, overload the crimes so that no one knows where to start. Syria becomes confusing, it's just a war, just collateral damage, and therefore any prospects of kind of justice get put aside for just a peace deal that wants to end this this misery. However, bad news for them, that the fact that the Syrian conflict has been so well documented might mean more work for us, but it's still possible. And I think that's one of the main issues that a lot of Syrians felt. It's like, how could you not know what's happening in Syria? We've been documenting so much. They felt that the fact that they're documenting so much meant less work when it comes to advocacy and pushing for policies and for accountability, which is, in my opinion, the opposite, because now you just have to navigate the system. And so, for example, I'm part of the legal team that is advising the government of the Netherlands against their kind of torture action. And it was very easy just to use secondary data to start with when we were compiling the secondary data of how many torture reports that were put together by the Commission of Inquiry, by the Committee Against Torture, the Treaty Body of the Torture Convention, by Syrian organizations, regional organizations, international organizations. It just requires someone to sift through it and to be able to kind of use it and say, have you read that report, and so on and so forth. Because there's so much documenting, a lot of people have, you know, gotten lost in all this detail, which is something that the late kind of foreign minister of Syria has said, you know, we will drown them in the detail so they better know how to swim. And that's when the kind of Arab League observers were planning to visit Syria to kind of monitor what is happening. The second thing is that I believe funding documentation and funding accountability is the sexy thing, the apolitical, easy thing for governments to do, right? They were funding documenting and accountability efforts in 2011 and 2012 when they could have prevented what they then spent millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in documenting. with, because of the legacies of Iraq, because of the legacies of Afghanistan, because of, you know, the Russian and like the proxy element of Syria, a lot of states felt it's easier just to, you know, fund the easy things, the ones that people would not kind of, you know, disagree on. Russia doesn't, you know, disagree about fighting impunity, just disagrees as for whom. And so use these kind of big slogans that we can fund when instead they could have prevented. So talking about a little bit of the current challenges when it comes to documentation and the wider civil society that is documenting. And I'm just going to point out two. So the first thing that we've seen is that because of the brutality of the Syrian regime and its allies, Syrian organizations, which were not present prior to 2011 due to the kind of police state that Syria was run under, found themselves always reacting reactively to what is happening in Syria, right? First, they deal with protesters, disappearance, killing of protesters, using of aircraft, bombing hospitals, chemical weapons, forced displacement, and you run out of breath trying to kind of, you know, document and deal with all of these conflict-related abuses. Now the conflict has calmed down. In the last 6 months, there have been no territorial shifts. And so a lot of these organizations that have been documenting first felt demoralized that because of all the documenting that they've done, nothing much has happened, but also kind of were like, what now? What do I do next, given the kind of conflict-related abuses that I know how to document are no longer existing? So there's an existential kind of crisis with a lot of Syrian organizations that for 10 or 8 or 9 years have been always, you know, reacting to the crimes committed in Syria, and we're not able to kind of think kind of proactively because they thought the international community would help. No Syrian would have thought that this would continue for so many years. And so it's important for these organizations to take a step back, and that's something we're assisting them to do, and say, okay, what is it that I want to achieve in the long term, given that Syria now is a long-term thing, and drafting those strategies. Obviously, drafting those strategies is very difficult because, you know, to draft a strategy, you need to have outcomes and indicators, and, you know, how do you measure your success in a deeply, deeply kind of concerning human rights, depressing, demoralizing situation, you know, and specifically that the organizations that continued to work until now are those who are trying, you know, notwithstanding all the challenges that I just mentioned, to kind of go on. The second difficulty that is there that needs to kind of be dealt with moving forward is the safe space to discuss, okay, we've documented so much, what is the next step? And that's particularly, you know, linked to what Salma has been talking about. The fact, you know, that there's so many different concepts of justice for so many different people. For those families who have disappeared, it might be the most temporary, the most immediate thing to find where their loved ones are. For refugees, it might be to, you know, to return. And that might mean compromises that other actors, other legitimate, independent, objective Syrian civil society actors might reject. How could you reconcile in order to return? Or how could you jeopardize trials in order to find your son? And there's no wrong and right answer in these situations. And I think the Syrian civil society that is kind of born out of the Syrian uprising, and it really needs to create that culture where I can share my thoughts, and Seema and Salma and everyone, within the Syrian civil society sphere to say, you know, I think these prosecutions are useful. Others might have a different views about them, that they're raising expectations. Some think victims organizations are excellent in preserving the truth. Others think it might make it more difficult, you know, for them to be able to take a step back and concede. So I really believe that in order to be able to kind of capitalize on all the documentation efforts, we need to understand that we need to put more work and not less work, notwithstanding that it's been so documented. We need to strategize how we're going to use that documentation, understanding the difficulties that are attached to that, and also create an internal Syrian safe space that allows us to reflect without, you know, raising, you know, the treason card, or, you know, you're lowering the boundaries, or, you know, you're kind of sitting in your ivory tower and all of that, or perhaps if having these accusations maybe in a closed room, but knowing that everyone is with, you know, the heart is in the right place, trying to get some sort of justice, or at least working towards justice together.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ibrahim, for all our panelists and for the participant who already put some very interesting questions. So I'm going to put some of these questions to the panelists and while we receive more of these. So I'm going to start with two questions that probably to the whole panel from Dima Norman from FCDO. She has two questions. First, she says, the report deduces that many activists believe that a political transition is an important prerequisite for pursuing transitional justice in Syria. However, as the prospect for such transition continue to fade, what are the chances of achieving justice in Syria? Second question from her is that your report also points towards growing recognition among Syrian civil society groups for the need of to align their documentation activities more closely with the needs and priorities of victims and affected communities. So would this, in your view, help to reduce the level of politicization in the documentation space? I have also two other specific questions, one to Ruti and the other one I think is more for Ibrahim. So the first one from Jess Keating to Professor Ruti is, you mentioned the concept of sustainable justice. Would you consider the position peace before justice is one that runs contrary to this concept? And from your expertise in such statement, peace before justice, one that stands up the test of time or one that makes matter worse? We also have a question from Yaman Marrawi, which I think Brahim, because of his involvement in this case, will probably be able to answer, is on the Netherlands and the fact that the Netherlands has recently notified Syria of its intention to hold the Assad regime under the United Nations Convention Against Torture. What should we make of this and what should we expect in the future? So who wants to start on the first two questions? Yavor and Sima, do you want to answer?
Sure. Thanks very much, Reem. I'll just take the first question on the chances for justice without sort of political transition. My instinct is that, as in other contexts, the expectation becomes frustrated, the thinking shifts in other ways. Some of the thinking that we're able to see in our research suggests that some activists are thinking actually about justice as a way of contributing to or even jumpstarting transition, and particularly I think those who work on accountability. Others I think are recognizing the fact that there are multiple goals in justice and particularly the victim-centered approach to justice. I think whatever kind of outcome ends up emerging, these issues about the conflict being about land transfer and property transfer at the local level, the potential for sort of conflict going forward in any kind of transition, whether it's predicated on, you know, partial temporary sort of freeze or partial victory, I think these questions never go away. And so in that sense, I think that the sort of the absence of political transition is not necessarily sort of stopping Syrian groups and international actors as well, but it is challenging them to think about it in a different way and to think about the role of documentation in potentially catalyzing forms of justice that can coexist with absence of transition or forms of justice that can precipitate or contribute to political transition.
Thank you, Yavor. Sima and Selma, would you like to add?
Sure, if I may. I think, you know, what Yavor is saying is right. And I think it's a shift from thinking about national processes to thinking what are the opportunities that are available now, whether they're, you know, on the margins, whether they're outside outside of Syria in terms of the cases that are being prosecuted outside, or whether it is, you know, working with communities and particular victims groups to elevate their voices, support them to get their demands. I think it's a shift in terms of also going, you know, to thinking what can we do for to build capacity, networks, and to take advantage of whatever opportunities there are to achieve justice or to build towards a justice later. And another, I think another one that's important is the issue of memorialization and documentation. And that is another space where I think justice and, you know, and truth telling is being, you know, contested. And it's an important space where Syrians can still at least fight to have their truth acknowledged, what happened to them, their experiences. And so I think this is one space where Syrians are, and Syrian civil society is trying to also pursue justice and truth telling.
Thank you, Selma. Brahim, on the question of the Netherlands.
Sure. So I think any kind of effort that could contribute to or takes us towards justice in the fight against impunity is something that is great. I think the Netherlands initiative has a couple of quick benefits. It takes the situation from just Syria to the international, kind of, it takes torture from Syria to the international community. It puts it in front, eventually, if it does get to the court, in front of 15 international judges. It makes it difficult to return refugees to Syria where they could be tortured. It sends a message that these crimes will not be condoned. It gives a platform for evidence to be presented in front of the UN's most senior court. You know, at a time where, you know, things are kind of calming down militarily, it's making clear that the situation in Syria is not just about the military, but crimes were committed. So there is a lot that could come out of it. But of course, we have to see it within the wider kind of context and manage expectations. It will not be the full kind of prospect of justice. It will not, you know, end the crimes they're currently committing, but it's definitely a step in the right direction, in my opinion.
Thank you. Ruti, there was a question directed to you. And I'm going to put another question also slightly related to you that came from Hugo Goodridge, says, what conflicts from history that have witnessed a resolution could be used as a blueprint for Syria to work from?
Thank you. Both great questions. And obviously, we don't have several hours to to review all prior conflict resolution. But I want to say that often peace and justice, that binary is overdone. And that what we see when you look historically is that, and I believe, you know, the jurist late Sharif Bassiouni wrote about this in the context of conflict resolution, and he was involved in documenting conflict, the offenses in the Balkans and also South Africa. And really what he highlighted is, and he would have loved to be involved in this panel, was the importance of justice for what I call, you know, and he did sustainable peace. And that is that you can say, well, let's sacrifice justice for peace now and just say, well, forget about the offenses and forget about redress. But what history has shown is that one does so at one's peril, and that you need accountability and rule of law for people, you know, in society to feel safe to return, right? You need accountability and rule of law to exclude past perpetrators from future political positions, and for the societies, generally security for the society. So these tend to be overly dichotomized, and what Bassiouni wrote about was the way justice, ordinary justice, is implied in peace. And you know, in established democracies, we don't think we're going to, you know, that we have to give up you know, justice for peace. And we think that you know, even if it's under-enforced, having a certain, you know, having courts, having possibility of litigation, having peaceful forms of conflict resolution, we think of that as intimately connected to peace, that justice is connected to peace. So I just want to say that. And I think that in terms of examples, and this connects, you know, the peace justice question to the second question, if we think of South Africa, the way justice was was a very important part of the deal with the ANC. If we think of Northern, the Good Friday Agreement, and we think of Colombia and the Havana Acuerdo, the Havana Agreement with the FARC, all of these involved difficult trade-offs, right? That in order to be able to get the various, you know, warring factions at the table, there had to be certain agreements that connect, that related to justice and connected justice and the peace. That doesn't mean it's a blueprint for Syria in the sense that, you know, with Northern Ireland, there were amnesties for those who were already on, in the criminal justice system. With Colombia and the FARC, what's exciting is that even with the current ICC, you know, monitoring and so forth, that they were able to come up with an agreement to alternative sanctions with an eye to the future, with to depoliticize, demilitarizing the FARC and making them part of the political process, and the importance of land restitution and the importance of other agreements. And it's very much victim-centered. So I would invite some of them, those who are working on Syria, to take a look at the Havana Agreement, precisely because, like the concerns in Syria, it has, you know, it involves the concern for four pillars. It involves the concern for accountability for perpetrators, but also is very much victim-centered. It has the Truth Commission and Truth in the Special Jurisdiction for Peace, and it and it's very concerned with reparatory justice going forward. I hope that was some way towards answering the question.
Yes, great. Thank you very much, Ruti. I'm going to go back to Yavor and Sima. There are some questions that are especially directed to you. So the first, we have one from Christine Cheng from the War Studies at King's College. She says, are there regional differences in your findings regarding collecting documentations, for example, Northeast Syria or Northwest versus the Syrian government controlled areas? For example, should expect that collecting data from the Assad areas to be more difficult. Yavor, would you, do you have an answer, or Sima?
I mean, I guess Sima could give more details than that. Well, I would just say that that the work, the documentation work that actually takes place on the ground is often driven, like in every conflict, by the opportunities to do that documentation work. And a lot of our respondents, for example, highlighted how when control over territory changes hands, as it has done in so many parts of Syria repeatedly, you know, pursuant to sort of agreements, local agreements between various factions, the sort of the situation is incredibly fluid and dynamic. At the same time, what new technologies have allowed, I think, to do is that they've really created a transnational community of documentation. And so, you know, people are using their private relationships in the diaspora. A lot of the human rights activists are outside of Syria, but retain very strong links on the ground. And so I think the geography of documentation is incredibly sort of dynamic and fragmented locally, but it's also incredibly transnational. And I think that's a very interesting and sort of significant development.
Okay, thank you. Yavor, while we're here, there is another question maybe you can answer from Sultan Kogalan. He says, do you think there would be peace to come into Syria in the long term? It is such crisis with many external actors involved in it. When the topic is the Middle East, thinking peace is really hard and far away. On the other hand, in the past, many documents collected about atrocities, ethnic cleansings, or forced displacement in many other countries in the region, but no officials were punished.
I wouldn't sort of dare to answer the question of whether or not peace will emerge. I think the question is what kind of settlement may emerge eventually. I mean, a lot of the questions that sort of, as Rudy pointed out, that center on this dichotomy seem to neglect the fact that in most contemporary conflicts, there are very rarely clear-cut endings. conflict recurrence, conflict persistence is a characteristic of these conflicts. And even where the violence ends, it seems to be more a freezing of the conflict, and then the potential to reignite at any moment. And I think that is the challenge for documentation and for transitional justice, is to think about situation where Syria may be for a long time in a gray zone between conflict and peace. And even if there is some kind of settlement with some movement towards democratization, again, the evidence is that post-conflict states are also in a gray zone between dictatorship and democracy. And so it is thinking about the role of documentation, the significance of documentation for justice that can coexist with these gray zone scenario, but also justice, forms of documentation that potentially might offer a direction, a sort of a way of nudging things away from conflict and in a direction of travel, at least, that is towards peace.
Thank you, Yavor. Brahim, there are two questions directed to you. One from Professor Omid Ongur from University of Amsterdam. He's saying 2020 and 2021 mark the years that a large number of Syrians will get German, Dutch, Swedish, etc. citizenships. What effect will that have on transitional justice for the survivors, but also for the perpetrators who will acquire European passports? There is another question for you also from Christine Cheng from War Studies and King's. She says, I also really appreciated your frank comments, Brahim. The safe space for victims is always difficult to negotiate in war to peace transition. And having the conversation in an honest way is even more challenging. So that was more like a comment. So, Brahim.
Thanks, Reem. To Professor Omid's question, I mean, thinking on top of my head, I see a couple of clear direct benefits. Obviously, the kind of court jurisdictional matter would depend on each country and what their laws say. But given that these crimes were committed at a time where they were not citizens, I would be surprised if you know, anything changes from that perspective, given that the courts may already have jurisdiction by virtue of them being present. However, the direct benefits, in my opinion, are first, given when they get citizenship, they get stability, so they're able to speak out more. So I would suspect that we get a lot of more victims that are not being afraid of being deported, they're not afraid of getting rid of their settled status, and so they're able to speak out more and share their experiences. And two, I see their ability to pressure their policymakers a bit more, because now they're voting constituents. So that would also, you know, they're now part of the system, and so might be able to push the politicians to do a little bit more on transition. So those are the kind of two main things that, you know, come to mind. Obviously, something else that has a big impact is, you know, when it comes to accountability and truth telling, is something that a lot of Syrians suffered from, is the ability to travel. You know, we can't get to New York, you can't get to Geneva, your travel document does not let you go and meet victims in regional countries. And if they do, you cannot bring them there and stuff like that. So having a passport, I think, would amplify the ability of, you know, activists and people and victims and survivors to travel, roam the world visa-free in order to be able to, I mean, after Corona, obviously, to be able to, you know, get their views across in a more meaningful way. And on the space, absolutely. And I think it's not just the space and the difficult conversation, it's the ability to take away Syrian pride, which is also a very almost impossible task, to say, I was wrong in 2019 to say we shouldn't have done this. Now I think it's the right thing. Or for me to say something in 2020 that I believe, you know, this approach is the best thing, and then backtrack and say, no, actually, this wasn't the correct thing, without anyone saying, ah, look, you didn't strategize properly, your thoughts changed, you're inconsistent, and all of that. And if I have that fear, I will not be able to voice my concerns properly. And so it's not just the conversation, it's also what happens after the conversation and the ability to reflect and say I was wrong, because we're always used to saying I was right.
Lovely, thank you very much, Brahim. I'm gonna move to Selma. I have two questions to you. The first is a bit difficult, it's short. It says, is there a hope for democracy in Syria? And if not, what comes next? The second question is on the role of media from George Hill. And he says, in your experience, how do visual forms of documentation compare to oral linguistic forms in capturing the international attention, especially across cultural boundaries?
It is a difficult question because I think, you know, every year, every development, we think something's going to happen. I mean, before the Russian intervention, did we think, you know, this would happen? After the Russian intervention, thought maybe this would be over, the regime would win, but maybe the war would be over. Then now we're in a stalemate, I think, where the war is frozen. Where do we go from here? It's very difficult for me to tell. I think in terms of, is there hope for democracy? Yes. Is it coming soon? Probably not. It's a ways away. It doesn't mean we don't, you know, I think a lot of the actors that were involved in the revolution are probably not the same people who are going to be, you know, there's be new people carrying the torch. It'll be a different, maybe a different way of doing things. It'll be a different messaging in different circumstances. What we can do is to support in different ways, whether it's documenting what happened and making sure that that is part of the conversation and the memory so that we don't, again, lose that history that we've lost, whether from Hama or other, you know, we need to keep that memory alive and the truth of what has happened, the lessons from what has happened, the skills that we've learned, and think about how we can pass them on to activists, to communities inside Syria, and in, you know, and those who have been displaced outside as well, inside and outside, and to support you know, the possibility of organizing, talking, collaborating, and taking advantage of what opportunities there are in order for new movements and new actors to push for democracy going forward. So it's a long process, and you know, our roles will shift, and we look at how we can be of use. And I like to say it's not just about hope, it's about a commitment and love for the people and for the country. And even if we're hopeless sometimes, we continue to fight for it and for those people. And how do we keep that memory alive? Part of that is through, you know, the second question on, you know, visual media and the role of visual media. I think that there's different ways in which that has played a part. First, you know, in capturing moments, in capturing where we were and where we are going. I think, you know, whether it's looking at posters, for instance, the work that Creative Memory has done in documenting the art, the posters related to the conflict and where we are as a, where we have been as activists and as a revolution, progression of that, or in terms of how we then tell the story of what happened. I think oral histories are very important, or storytelling is very important, whether that is even the families. I think there was a marked difference in terms of, you know, in terms of whether you read a report about detention and hear about, yes, 100,000, and between hearing the story of a mother that still cooks this meal because her child, she, you know, that was the meal she made when she was expecting him to come home and he never did. And, you know, and those stories, whether, you know, it's individuals telling them and through testimonials and, or whether we capture them and we capture the human impact of the conflict and the violence through storytelling, you know, through media, movies, you know, they have an impact in terms of really bringing home the scale of the conflict and of the violations, of making it, of touching people and spurring them to action. And I think they are a way we can speak to stories that we wouldn't, or violations that we wouldn't otherwise want to talk about. For instance, issues like sexual violence or otherwise things that have been taboo, you know, media, visual, different ways of storytelling are important, not just to memorialize an issue, but to also bring to light issues that are underrepresented and under highlighted.
Thank you very much, Selma. I'm moving to Seema now. We have two questions to Seema. The first one, I'll go back to the previous question about whether you observed any differences in the documentation between the different parts in Syria. And also there is a question that came from Zaki Mehji on the coordination between different civil society organizations on documentation. Is there enough coordination? And if not, what can be done to improve it? Seema, and if you want to answer in Arabic, I'm happy to translate.
شكرا ريم انا اكيد بفضل اجاوب بالعربي وشكرا خلفا على الترجمه السؤال الاول بما يتعلق بالتوثيق بحسب المناطق المختلفه هلا اكيد في صعوبات دائما التوثيق هو ما له شيء جاذب لاصحاب السلطه فبمناطق النظام اكيد هو ما راح يرحب بالاشخاص اللي بيوثقوا ضده الانتهاكات اللي بيرتكبها هو بالمقابل ما كانت كتير في فرق بالمناطق الثانية لا بمناطق سيطرة قوات سوريا الديمقراطية ولا بمناطق سيطرة الجيش الحر ولا الوطني ولا النصرة ولا أكيد الكل يعني نحن واجهنا نفس الصعوبات بكل المحلات هلا التحدي كان الكبير أنه مع كل تغير بخارطة الصراع أنه نرجع نبني فريق جديد وندرب فريق جديد ونضمن انه هذا يعني هو اصعب شيء انه نضمن هذا الشخص عنده المصداقيه او ما انه متحيز للجهه المسيطره مثلا او هلا في صعوبات بهذا الخصوص يعني يعني للاسف دائما بنخسر بشكل متواصل الباحثين تبعونا لانه بس سيطرت يعني بس خضعت منطقه لسيطره حدا ثاني بيضطر هدول الاشخاص انه يقطعوا التواصل او ينتقلوا لمكان ثاني فهيدي للاسف تحدي كثير كبير بمناطق شرق الفولات بشكل خاص يعني في يعني هيك خليني أقول إيحاء بأنه في جو من الديمقراطية موجود وأنه في مسموح لمنظمات المجتمع المدني تشتغل بحرية بس حقيقة لا لما بيكون في انتهاكات مرتكبة من قبل هذه السلطات المنظمات المجتمع المدني ما بتقدر تحكي على العلن اللي موجودة هناك ما بتقدر تحكي عن العلن بتنسق مع منظمات برا هاي المناطق لتحكي عن هاي الانتهاكات فهنا بيتعاملوا بهذا الإطار بيعطونا ممكن معلومات لأن نحن ما نتواجد هناك مثلا لحتى نحن نحكي بدالهم خليني أقول قمع عملية التوثيق هو موجود دائما بكل المناطق بخصوص السؤال الثاني يمكن جاوبت على جزء منه هو مثلا بهيك موقف بيصير في نوع من التنسيق بين المنظمات الثانية بس إجمالا في يعني في حد أدنى من التنسيق بين المنظمات بس كمان برجع ما بدي أبين إنه أنا بحيز المنظمات النسوية بس فعلا المنظمات النسوية بسهولة بتلاقي التشبيك بين بعضهم أسهل نعمل مشاريع مع بعض بيطلع أسهل بكتير ما بيكون في كتير يعني دائما في عنا شوية نظرة يعني وحدة فبتحسي إنه الأسهل بين بعض والمنظمات الصغيرة كمان سهل بين بعض أنهم ينسقوا من المنظمات شوية كبيرة بيكون الإيجو عندهم شوية عالي فما بيتنازلوا ينسقوا مع حدا ففي بس أكيد في يعني حد أدنى من التنسيق بين المنظمات في حد معقول يعني
Thank you, Seema. So I'm going to translate on the differences between different areas. Seema says, when it comes to documenting human rights abuses, all authorities don't like this and they always resist it. And this applies to all different regions in Syria. So she haven't seen real differences between the area controlled by the Syrian government or Syria Democratic Forces or the Free Syrian Army or SGS, the Al-Qaeda Associated Organization. They all don't like and don't welcome documentation. She said even in the SDF areas that give the impression that they are pro-democracy, pro-civil society, actually the reality we've seen when it comes to documentation of human rights abuses is completely different from that beautiful image. The reality is that when they commit violations, and human rights organizations in their areas don't have enough space to speak out and to call them on it. So what they do is that they coordinate with the organizations that are based abroad, like Siemens organization, and they report these violations to them, and then those abroad will be able to speak out. Siemens says the challenge, the biggest challenge that this geographical division of Syria brings is the fact that it always changes, and one area is captured by different authorities. So every time they have to create a new team, you know, they create a team on the ground, they have their networks, they train them, and then suddenly this area is captured by another authority. So they all have to wrap up and relocate to another area. So you have to create a new team in this area. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges. On the issue of coordination, as the example that Sima brought about, for example, working with those on the ground and those abroad, can tell you that there is coordination. And overall, she says there is a minimal level of coordination, but maybe not enough. But what she highlighted is that actually, particularly among the women-led organization and the feminist organization, the coordination seems to be much higher and much easier. So she says, even when we run projects together, they just run smoother. And we find that we have our visions are closer to each other. She also says that in general, coordinating between small organizations seems to be much easier and smoother than coordinating with the very large organizations. Thank you very much, Sima. So we don't have a lot of time left. There is just one last question I'm gonna put to you speakers, which is about the Biden. What do you expect now from the upcoming Biden administration? And there's any hope for effectiveness of the Constitutional Committee? I don't know who wants to answer that.
Well, I can say something as the probably yes, the token American in the in the group, but this is in the area of crystal balls, reading the tea leaves. Well, one thought obviously is that, I mean, the first would be that the Biden administration transition team has already been making noises about being multilateral and not America first, and Biden has already said that he's going to rejoin the Paris Pact. I mean, there are about 12 treaties that the Trump administration pulled out of, including the World Health Organization, and including environmental. So that's the general approach, and I think that already is very welcome. This multilateral and more cooperative approach, and it's obviously what is needed in global times. And we know that that the Syrian conflict is international, and so that's an approach that is appropriate for that conflict. The other thing is it's important to recall that Biden worked in the Obama administration, and Obama had enunciated a red line regarding Syria, right? The famous line about the use of chemical weapons, and it was considered a difficult and bad moment when there wasn't the intervention when chemical weapons were used. So again, that doesn't mean that the intervention can will be military in nature, but it does mean that there was a concern about the normativity about these atrocious offenses that have transnational implications. And he was part of that administration, and so that's something to think about. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Any of the other panelists would like to add something?
I think the fact that in Obama's book he called or mentioned that Syria was a mistake of his, that actually gives the opportunity for Joe to fix things if he wants to, right? And because he was VP during that time, but I think he has a lot of other priorities at the moment that would not keep Syria up on the agenda. Is my feeling. And so I think we're in for a long stalemate on things. So I'm not hopeful for any kind of drastic change in policy at the moment.
Thank you very much, Brahim. Any other panelists would like to come before we close down?
Just, I think I agree with Brahim that there's many other priorities, and I don't think the only thing I would say is I hope that the United States can regain some sort of or have some sort of leadership on human rights and democracy. I think that's all we can ask for, as opposed to at this point any intervention. As a bare minimum is to not be speaking at the Security Council with a Security Council member that is jailing children. So I think, or putting children in cages. So I think, and you know, any moral leadership on human rights would be welcome.
Thank you very much, Selma. I mean, with this, we come to the end of our event. Thank you very much for everyone who stayed with us until now and for all the questions you posted. I'm really sorry that we couldn't answer all the questions. Please feel free to contact us if you have specific questions, and I'll be happy to direct your questions to the panelists through emails. Big thank you to all our panelists for the presentation and for all what you do for justice in Syria and worldwide. Thank you so much, Sima and Yavor, for great work. I know how much time that took from you. I attended many of the meetings. I enjoyed translating the conversation. That is very valuable, and I hope it's going to make a mark in the process of transitional justice in Syria. Thank you all, and hope to see you in future events. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Reem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.